What I'm going to be talking about today is basically not so much about the crime itself of 9/11, but the way that the crime has been used to bring us into the war on terror, a war that we've been in for the last 15 years, and how actually these two things fit very closely together. They come from the same source. They were done for the terror attacks of 9/11 were done in order to make the war on terror become real. The war on terror was in fact planned and prepared decades before. So 9/11 was carried out to kickstart the war on terror, which is a Zionist war agenda of aggression, terrorism, and conquest. When I use the word Zionist, I'm referring to the idea of the Jewish nationalism. That Zionism is our people. A Zionist is a person who supports the political ideology of Jewish nationalism, which is what the State of Israel is. The State of Israel was founded and promoted from the very beginning by the Rothschild family of France and in London, bankers, big bankers. So 9/11 was wrongly blamed on Muslims to trick us into supporting an open-ended and criminal war agenda across the Middle East, across the Islamic world. The fraudulent war on terror has cost the United States $2.5 trillion. That's how much we've paid already. So as good citizens, we are obliged to resist the 9/11 deception and enslavement to a criminal war agenda. I was an investigative journalist in Washington, D.C. when 9/11 happened. I wrote for a little weekly newspaper there called American Free Press. My degree is in history. My specialty is Israel and Palestine from the University of California at Santa Cruz. I'm the author of those two books, and prior to all of that, I was an Eagle Scout, and I grew up outside Chicago in a place called Schaumburg, Illinois. This is the main book, The Deception That Changed the World. Now, understanding what 9/11 was, it was a highly sophisticated false flag terror atrocity which employed something called shock and awe. Shock and awe is when you overwhelm a population with something so spectacular, so tremendous, that they are left in awe. And that was done to create fear and rage in the population to compel us to then support the suggested war option, the war on terror. So starting the war on terror was the primary reason for the false flag terror attacks of 9/11. 9/11 itself was a policy coup that brought us the war on terror and a series of costly wars like this serious situation in Iraq, which it's interesting to note that Americans are fighting in Iraq once again today. We're still fighting there. Currently, the U.S. troops are trying to liberate the city of Mosul from Islamic State. So we've been deceived about 9/11. But 9/11 was just the beginning. The 9/11 cover-up was necessary, was required, to deceive the public into supporting this open-ended war agenda against Islamic nations. We will not have peace if we allow ourselves as a nation, as a population, to remain deceived. Because if you're deceived, a nation that is deceived is a nation that's enslaved. If you follow the deception, if you accept the deception, then you will follow the escape that's provided you for you to get out of that deception or to get safety, what you think is safety. So the media has imposed on the public this false story that radical Islamic terrorists are to blame for 9/11. This has been the story that we were given from the New York Times and the media from day one. And the only way to liberate ourselves and our nations from this madness, which we've been in for the last 15 years, is to expose the true source of terrorism. Now, I live most of the time in Europe, and I can tell you that in Sweden and Europe, the situation is very bad with refugees. We have the largest flows of refugees currently on the road in Sweden and Europe since World War II. But Sweden does a very good job of housing them, but two summers ago, Sweden was receiving 3,000 Syrian refugees per week. It's a lot. Now, what happened on 9/11 was that the Bush administration declared the attacks to be an act of war. And that's a legal expression, because an act of war means that the crime was not to be investigated and prosecuted as a crime. Rather, the military would be the agency that would seek justice for the crime. So there was no criminal investigation. This is something most Americans don't understand. There has not been a proper criminal investigation of 9/11. Rather, they said it's an act of war. And that night, September 11th, the Bush administration had a cabinet meeting, and they decided to go to war in Afghanistan already that night. This is a statement by Larry Johnson, former deputy director of counterterrorism at the State Department, on September 28th. He talked about this. This was in the Sun Sentinel, South Florida paper. He said they were extremely well organized. He said these guys, the 19 Arabs, were just committed zealots and willing to give it up for the cause without being key members of the network. They were told what to prepare for, what to train for. They were not the ones calling the shots. We don't have anything in history to compare with this. The only thing that comes close to it is a former Soviet intelligence operation. Now, this is a man who understood, he was understanding already the false identities that were being used by these people in South Florida. There were 15 of the 19 Arabs lived here, and they had multiple identities. People were laying trails for them. And so this person, Larry Johnson, understood that this was a very sophisticated operation. Not something that was planned in Afghanistan. Certainly not something that was carried out by some Arab students from Germany. Now, our situation is very serious, because if the government and media are lying to us about 9/11, it means that they are controlled by the very same people who carried out 9/11. That stands to reason, because the only people who are benefiting from the cover-up are the actual culprits. A common source, both the 9/11 terror conspiracy and the war on terror were conceived and planned in Israel in the late 1970s by Israeli military intelligence. First, a little background on the war on terror. On September 20th, 2001, George Bush, President Bush, declared war on terror, saying that every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you're with the terrorists. Again, the cost of the war on terror, the war fighting alone since 2001 has cost $1.7 trillion, Homeland Security about $700 billion. So it's $2.5 trillion already borrowed money laid out for the war on terror since 9/11. Now, you can imagine how far that kind of money would go on improving American infrastructure or schools, hospitals, necessary things. It's been spent in wars in which the United States has no national interest. We have no national interest in Afghanistan. We have no interest in Syria. We have no interest in Iraq. But we've spent incredible amounts of money waging war there, besides the incredible loss of life. Now, the fact of the matter is that even today, even after the Orlando shooting, an American is less likely to die from terrorism as they are from being hit by lightning. But we're spending this incredible amount of money. We're spending $400 million per year per U.S. victim of terrorism. And compare that to how much we spend on cancer victims or flu victims or heart disease, you can see that it's obscene. It's a waste. It's more than that. It's a fraud. It's a criminal fraud. The money is in this war effort. So these are some protesters, and they say the war on terror is a fraud. Of course. And the fraudulent war on terror is based on the official myth of 9/11, what we've been given by the media and by our government. But where did the war on terror come from? Well, I'm going to explain that the war on terror is an evolution of an Israeli stratagem. A stratagem is a device to trick your enemy. The war on terror is an Israeli stratagem, a ploy pushed by Benjamin Netanyahu since 1979 to trick the United States into waging war against Israel's enemies. One of the key advocates of the war on terror is Bibi Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel. He's the longest-serving prime minister of Israel, actually. From 76 to 78, he worked for a company called Boston Consulting in Boston, which is a Rothschild-owned company. Then in 1979, he came back to Israel and started something called the Jerusalem Institute, or the Netanyahu Institute. And the first event that they had was in July 1979, and it was called the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism. George Herbert Walker Bush spoke there. It was the July 4th weekend, and Mr. Bush was running for president, if you recall, against Ronald Reagan. And George Bush went there and attended the conference and spoke at the final session. And the purpose of this conference was to shift the propaganda, the public understanding of the threats of the world. And it went from civil rights, the switch was to international terrorism. Previously, it had been civil rights. And it's interesting, in this conference in 1979, they tried to blame the Soviet Union for all international terrorism. Now, that's important to keep in mind because, again, we see today this hostility for Russia and the former Soviet Union, which is part and parcel of the same deception. So Bibi Netanyahu made a book out of the first conference in 1979. It's called International Terrorism, Problems and Solutions, I think. Then he wrote another book. These books came out of other conferences he had. They had another conference in 1984. Terrorism, How the West Can Win, and Fighting Terrorism. So he made a career in the 80s of pushing this idea that the Western democracies, led by the United States, had to come to the Middle East to wage war against those terrorist entities who were plaguing Israel. And the logic goes something like this. He said that Israel is being attacked by these Islamic forces because they don't like Western values. And he said Israel is a piece of the West, basically, and therefore the entire West is being hit by this. So therefore the West needs to come to the aid of the outpost of Israel. And this is the same logic they use today. The father of terrorism, our modern concept of modern day terrorism actually started in Israel. And the nation was founded in 1948 very much on the back of international terrorism. And in 1974, a British journalist asked Menachem Begin, the man with the glasses, he asked him, how does it feel in the light of all that's going on to be the father of terrorism in the Middle East? And Menachem Begin, who is from Russia, said, in the Middle East, he said, in all the world. So he was taking upon himself the mantle of being the father of terrorism. He had no qualms about that. And the man in the foreground is, of course, the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, who is today the head of the same party that Mr. Begin started back in 1973. And Menachem Begin has a long history of terrorism. He was the head of the group called the Irgun in Israel, in Palestine, pre the State of Israel. And he was responsible for the bombing of the King David Hotel. There's not many photos of it. That's his handiwork there. And Menachem Begin of the Irgun and David Ben-Gurion of the Haganah ordered the bombing, which killed 93 people, including 14 British officers. Now, this particular atrocity was the worst atrocity in Israeli-Palestinian history. It killed 93 people. But what's interesting is that it's very similar to 9/11. It was, in this case, what was really occurring was not just, you know, hitting the British headquarters. It was also destroying evidence that the British had collected the previous month. And the evidence, the documents and the evidence they had collected would have basically ended the Zionist enterprise in Palestine because they found that the Jewish agency was involved in terror. So they had to destroy the evidence. And 9/11 was also an act in which lots and lots of evidence was destroyed. So Begin came to Israel from Russia. He arrived in Palestine in 42. He became the leader of the Irgun in 44 and then bombed the King David Hotel in 46. He also committed something called the Deir Yassin Massacre, in which an entire Palestinian village was massacred, with the people were blown up inside their houses and things like that. And this was done as a spectacle in order to compel, to persuade the other Palestinians that they better leave rather than face the fate of the people of Deir Yassin. And then he became prime minister. He created the Likud. The Likud he created with his other fellow terrorists. And in 1977, he became prime minister. And then promptly invaded Lebanon. This is the emblem of his group, the Irgun, also known as Etzel. And you can see that they have this notion of a biblical state of Israel taking up a much larger piece of land than what is today Israel. This is called Eretz Israel, or the Greater Israel. And this is the notion that people from the Likud have, that they have a God-given right to the whole biblical notion of Israel as far as it could expand at any point. So it goes into Jordan, it goes into Lebanon, goes into Egypt, goes into Iraq, even goes into Saudi Arabia. And as you can see on this emblem, it says in Hebrew at the top, Rakkach, meaning Only thus, the only solution is the gun. Only with the gun will we accomplish the territory that we desire. And what's interesting, in this group, the Irgun, comes from an ideology that was promoted by a man named Zev Jabotinsky. And Zev Jabotinsky created something called the New Zionist Organization. He died in 1940, Zev Jabotinsky did. He actually wrote in 1922 that there had to be built an iron wall between the Palestinian population and the Jewish population. And that's what was built after 9/11. If you recall, in 2002, 2003, you know, Trump wants to build his wall. Well, Mr. Ariel Sharon built his wall across the Holy Land. So if you go to Bethlehem today or Jerusalem, or if you go to the West Bank, you'll see this big wall. It's 40 times longer than the Berlin Wall and twice as high. Well, what happened when Mr. Jabotinsky died in New York City is Bibi Netanyahu's father took over that organization in New York City. And his name was Ben-Zion Milakovsky Netanyahu. So Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has been raised in this ideology. And this is what they aspire to. This is called What Israel's Future Borders Will Look Like. It's from an Israeli website. And Menachem Begin said, after the partition plan in 1947, when the United Nations tried to partition Palestine, Menachem Begin said, the partition of Palestine is illegal. Jerusalem was and will forever be our capital. And Eretz Israel will be restored to the people of Israel, all of it and forever. Now, it's important to understand that this is the doctrine of the Likud party. This is the doctrine of Menachem Begin, and this is the doctrine of Bibi Netanyahu. Hasn't changed anything. So here, Begin became the prime minister in 1977. This happened to be the time when I lived in Israel. And this was a earthquake in Israeli politics because the Labor Party had been in power for 30 years prior, from the birth of Israel until this time. And then these ruthless kind of terrorist guys, they created a party and they took over. They defeated the Labor Party. And my girlfriend at the time, an Israeli labor kibbutznik, she cried. She said, this is the day that Israel died. The terrorists have taken over. So here are the troika of terrorists that took over. Menachem Begin, and on the right, Yitzhak Shamir, and on the left, Ariel Sharon. And Yitzhak Shamir, he headed another group called the Lehi, or Stern Gang. And he was responsible. His group was very, very right-wing and very militant. And they were involved in killing the United Nations envoy who was sent there to try and make peace in 1948. He was named Folke Bernadotte. He's a Swedish count there. And he was killed Bonnie and Clyde style by Yitzhak Shamir's gang outside Jerusalem. One of the members of his gang was this man's father. You might recall, this is Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago. He was also a special advisor to Bill Clinton for 8 years. And he was Barack Obama's first appointed person. He was chief of staff. And when he was chief of staff, he made a very disparaging remark about Arabs, but the media didn't seem to think that was anything, that needed to be criticized. But so Rahm Emanuel comes from that same breed, and he has that same ideology. Actually, this man, he was working for Bill Clinton, and in 1991, he went back to Israel and served in the Israeli army during the first Gulf War as an Israeli soldier. Here are some of the original terrorists from the State of Israel: Shimon Peres, Pinhas Lavon, and Moshe Dayan. And this photograph was taken 1 month after something called the Lavon Affair. The Lavon Affair is something that's not very well understood because it's not taught in any of the courses you'll study about Zionism. The Lavon Affair was an attempt by these Israelis to divide America and Britain away from Egypt by putting bombs in libraries and cultural buildings in Egypt, in Cairo and Alexandria. And these bombs, nitroglycerin bombs, were meant to be blamed, the terrorism was meant to be blamed on the Muslim Brotherhood. And that would make America, the United States, and Britain less cozy with Nasser. But what happened is that it went wrong. Some of the bombs went off prematurely, and the Egyptian police caught some of the terrorists, and those terrorists confessed. They said they knew the other people. And some of them were hanged. Several were hanged in Egypt, and some spent long prison sentences. But the men who ran the operation were these men. It was Shimon Peres on the left. He was director of the defense ministry, first man. Pinhas Lavon, the affair is named after him. He was defense minister. And then Moshe Dayan was chief of staff. And so these are the men who ran the whole operation. And they ran it as a covert operation, unbeknownst to the prime minister at the time. The prime minister at the time was a man named Moshe Sheret. And when Moshe Sheret found out, he was livid. He was the foreign minister and he was the defense prime minister at the time. And he absolutely despised Shimon Peres. And later he wrote in this book called Israel's Sacred Terrorism, a very good book. He wrote that Peres shares the same ideology as Lavon. He wants to frighten the West into supporting Israel's aims. And this is exactly what's going on. They're using terrorism to frighten us. Terrorism is a tool to frighten the public into being obedient and compliant with the wishes of the terrorist. So what has this taken? Where has this taken us? This has taken us on a very bloody path. The past 15 years, the United States has basically destroyed a half a dozen nations in the Middle East, displaced millions of people who are now wandering around Europe looking for a place to live, and killed many Americans, and greatly devastated our national prosperity and prestige. It's done tremendous damage to this country. And people have to understand that this is a deception. Because when you understand the deception, then it loses its power. And we have to inform a lot of people. And, you know, it's going to take some time, but we're trying. In 1948, when Israel was being created, before the state even became a state, the Joint Chiefs of Staff wrote 13 papers about what Israel would mean to the American foreign policy. And they wrote, the 13th paper was called Force Requirements for Palestine, 1948, talking about how much force, military force, the United States would have to send to the region. And they said in the paper, Zionist strategy will seek to involve the United States in a continuously widening and deepening series of operations intended to secure maximum Jewish objectives. And in the paper, they described two of the most important Jewish objectives were these: the expansion of Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, into Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. And two, the establishment of Jewish military and economic hegemony over the entire Middle East. That's what's going on today. And in 1948, this man, he was a Rothschild employee. He came from the settlement called Rishon LeZion, which was built by the Rothschild family. It means the first in Zion. Well, this man, David Ben-Gurion, told his general staff, his military people, 1 week after Israel became a state, he said, we should prepare to go over to the offensive with the aim of smashing Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. And when we smash the Arab Legion's strength and bomb Amman, we will eliminate Jordan as well, and then Syria will fall. If Egypt dares to fight on, we will bomb Port Said, Alexandria, and Cairo. So for a little nation that had escaped annihilation, he had big plans. And he was calling for, aggressing the entire region. Some people will balk when you explain to them that Israel was involved in 9/11 and you talk about this, they'll say, oh no, Israel wouldn't do that. You know, there's many Christian Zionists in this country who say, no. Israel's our strategic ally. I would just point out, they should read some history. In 1967, in the Six-Day War, on June 8th, Israeli military, air force, and navy viciously attacked a ship called the USS Liberty, which was an unarmed American spy ship under the NSA off the coast of Egypt in international waters. And it was flying an oversized American flag, and the Israeli pilots were flying over the ship. They'd been buzzing over it all morning long before the attack began. And then the attack began. They hit it with a torpedo in the middle, killing 34 Americans, and they bombed it, dropped napalm. And there was a couple years ago, the transcripts came out between the pilots and ground control. And the pilots' ground control in Tel Aviv said, identify the plane, identify the ship. And the planes called back and said, it's American, it's American. And then the command came from Tel Aviv, sink the ship, no survivors. So they intended to put this ship on the bottom of the ocean, but it was one of those old World War II Liberty Hull ships which have good compartments underneath, and it didn't go down. The torpedo went right in the middle of the ship and killed all of the guys down below with the headphones on that were interpreting the signals intelligence. Killed all of them, but the ship didn't sink. But when the Americans tried to put life rafts into the water, the Israeli gunboats were machine gunning the life rafts. They had no intention. They intended the ship to go down the bottom. And had it gone to the bottom, it would have been blamed on Egypt. And this would have brought us very close to a nuclear war. But that's another story. This was a, you know, Lyndon Johnson was in the White House, and he was very, very pro-Israel. And so twice, American planes were launched from aircraft carriers off the coast of Greece to rescue the ship. And twice, McNamara and Johnson called the planes back. He said, I will not embarrass an ally. So 171 Americans were brutally wounded on the ship and 34 killed. And that little piece of history is not generally well known in America because it's not taught. It's simply suppressed. So seven countries in 5 years. This is General Wesley Clark. And he went to the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11, he said. And he said, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. And he said, one of the generals called me in and said, sir, we've made the decision we're going to war with Iraq. And he said, we're going to war with Iraq? Why? I don't know, he said. He said, I came back a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? He said, sir, it's much worse than that. We're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq, then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran. And he said this in March 2007 in several speeches. Now, you can see from that shopping list, 5 of those nations have already been done. Lebanon has already pretty much broken up along ethnic lines. And really, the only one that's left is Iran. And you see, with our current president, Donald Trump, he's very gung-ho, actually, at least what he says, in waging war with Iran. Now, you know, waging war with Iran would be disastrous for us and for the whole region, so I hope he doesn't do that. I hope he has enough sense to avoid that kind of thing. But this is the shopping list. Now, whose shopping list is this? What American interest is it? Wesley Clark was confused. What American interest is it in overthrowing these 7 Middle Eastern countries? Well, it's an Israeli plan, and it's called the Yenon Plan, named after the guy who wrote it, Oded Yenon. Oded Yenon published this in an Israeli magazine called Kivunim in 1982 in February. And Kivunim is the journal for Judaism and Zionism. It's published in Jerusalem by the World Zionist Organization. That's the very top of the Zionist enterprise. Like I said, that's the state of Israel. Zionism is the ideology upon which Israel is based. And the Yenon plan, according to the man who translated, Israel Shahak, a professor of chemistry, he said it represents the accurate and detailed plan of the present Zionist regime, the Likud, for the Middle East, which is based on the division of the whole area into small states and the dissolution of all existing Arab states. So what it means is something called Balkanization. You break up a country, a big country, and you reduce it to ethnic components, like what we've done in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was a large socialist state, you know, in southeastern Europe, and now today it's, I think, 7 little statelets. Iraq is de facto 3 states today. Kurdistan in the north, ISIS area, Sunni area in the west, and the Shiite area in the south. Syria is very fragmented. Whether it stays that way or not, we'll see. Tripoli, Libya has been fractured into 2 or 3 pieces. Sudan is now de facto or de jure 2 countries, South Sudan and Sudan. Somalia is chaos. Yemen is chaos. The whole Middle East is chaotic. We don't see it that much because our media is more interested in manipulating our point of view than informing us of what's happening. But, you know, a day doesn't go by that some terrible atrocity doesn't happen in one of those countries. So this is the Yenon plan. And thanks to Israel Shahak, a personal friend of mine, in 1982 he translated this document into English so that we would understand what the Zionist policy or plan was for the region. So after 9/11, the Israeli connection, of course, became more pronounced. And here you have at the White House, at the Pentagon, you have something called the Defense Policy Board. And the Defense Policy Board is a bunch of civilians, basically at that time neocons, Jewish neocons, who made policy for the Pentagon. And, you know, the head guy was Deputy Defense Minister Secretary Wolfowitz at the head of the table here. And across the table, smiling with the mustache, that's Rabbi Dov Zakheim. and he was the comptroller at the Pentagon. You might recall he was the man who said the day before, or no, he was the comptroller of the funds. The day before 9/11, Rumsfeld told the public that there's a missing $2.3 trillion, unaccountable, in the defense budget. That was on September 10th, 2001. He announced that. And sitting next to the Israeli man there, the Israeli man is the guy with the red beret. He's the Shaul Mofaz, an Iranian Jewish guy. And he was chief of staff. He's Israeli chief of staff. And here he is sharing notes, explaining to his Zionist colleagues at the Defense Department what they should do. And the man with something in his eye, that's Douglas Feith. Douglas Feith, his father was in the Irgun. He's an American, but his dad was in the Irgun. And because his father was an Israeli, he is also then an Israeli as well. And we see that this idea of supporting Israel's agenda, it was made very clear when Hillary Clinton wrote this email that was released about a year ago. Secretary of State Clinton wrote that in this memo, the best way to help Israel is to use force in Syria to overthrow the government. So that's why under Obama was spending $1 billion per year to run this covert operation. We, the Americans, have been funding all of those radical Islamist groups that have been causing chaos over there in Syria. They've been using pure terrorism, killing young men, you know, pushing people off buildings, crucifying people, everything in the book to make it look really, really awful, to make Islam look really, really bad. This email from Hillary Clinton proves that Obama and Hillary were trying to overthrow the Syrian government because it was in Israel's interest, not ours. And you see, devastation in Syria, we have to take ownership of this. We, as Americans, our government, fostered this. And it's caused a great deal of, half the country has been displaced. 11 million people out of a country of 25 million. And 4 million are living outside the country. A lot of my neighbors are from Syria. So 22 years after it was born in Jerusalem, the Israeli war on terror became operational after 9/11. So the purpose of 9/11 was to start this Israeli war agenda, this Zionist war agenda. And they used their agent here, Osama bin Laden, to impress upon us that he was the bad guy. So I'm going to talk about the Israeli connections to 9/11. And these are some points to show you that the Israeli connection to 9/11 and the Israeli connection to the war on terror, that these both of these things come from the same place and for the same reason. First one is ideation. Putting the idea out there of a 9/11 attack is possible. In 1978, Arnon Milchan, a senior Israeli intelligence agent, made his first movie called The Medusa Touch, in which a Boeing 747 goes into the Pan Am building in New York City. This is the cover of the book, and that's Arnon Milchan. So he made this. He's a very senior agent. He's involved in nuclear smuggling from the United States to Israel. And here he is talking to Ezra Weizman in the same year he made the movie in England. Milchan with Ezra Weizman, defense minister, 1978. So where did he get this idea of a 9/11 type attack? You know, where did this idea come from? Well, it was probably being planned already at that time, and I'll show you it was. So this is how they've set up the props to, you know, the plane flying into the Pan Am building. Milchan is a very high Israeli agent. He's a top agent in a group called LACAM. LACAM, L-A-K-A-M, is actually the very secret organization that was set up to smuggle nuclear components to Israel from the United States. And he's worth something like $5 billion. He made JFK, he made Brazil, he made Pretty Woman, I think. He made quite a few films. The movie Brazil is quite interesting. He made that one in 1986. It's a futuristic film in which terrorism happens all the time. And the nation that the people live in is fighting a war on terror against in some far-flung region. And in 2000, his business partner, Rupert Murdoch from Fox News, they made another film in which the World Trade Center was attacked by a plane. And in this case, it was a passenger aircraft that was remotely hijacked and flown into the World Trade Center. And Rupert Murdoch and Arnon Milchan are business partners. They have a television company together. So the idea probably came from Mr. Milchan. This was aired on Fox TV in March 2001. It was viewed by 13 million U.S. viewers. 6 months before 9/11. Now, in the father of Israeli intelligence, the man who was the founding chief of the Mossad for the first 15 years, this is this man, Yisr Harel. And Yisr Harel predicted in 1979 that Arabs would attack the tallest buildings in New York. 22 years before it happened. He predicted it to this tall man here. His name is Michael Evans. He's a Zionist preacher from Texas. And you can see Mr. Evans is quite close to the Likud. He's good friends with Menachem Begin, the prime minister at the time. This is the prediction. In 1979, Mr. Evans was having dinner at Harel's house. So you see he's very highly connected. Not everybody has dinner at the Mossad chief's house. And he said, "Do you think terrorism will come to America? And if so, where and why?" And Yisr Harel said, "I fear it will come to you in America. America has the power but not the will to fight terrorism. The terrorists have the will but not the power to fight America. But all that could change with time. Arab oil money buys more than tents." As to the where, Harel continued, "New York City is the symbol of freedom and capitalism. It's likely they will strike the Empire State Building, your tallest building, and a symbol of your power." So you can see that the prediction was there, the ideas were there, and then they put that plan into action. Then two of Yisr Harel's top lieutenants from the Mossad, these older guys, they went to New York to get the security contract for the World Trade Center. And they got it in 1987. The president of the company was called Atwell Security of Tel Aviv. The head of the company was this Avraham Shalom, who was the former head of the Shin Bet. Now, Mr. Shalom had a little problem. In 1984, there had been a bus hijacking in Israel. Palestinians hijacked a bus on the coast. The Israeli forces went in there and got the people released, you know, the passengers. And they caught two of the hijackers. And the agents in the field said, "Okay, we got these two Palestinian guys. What do we do with them?" He said, "Smash their heads with rocks." And that's what they did. And because of that command was an illegal command, it was not proper, Mr. Shalom Ben-Dor, Avraham Shalom, was removed as head of Shin Bet. He lost his position, and he was looking for a new job. So he went to New York under Mossad and got a job in charge of security at the World Trade Center. Now, Atwell Security of Tel Aviv was the company that was set up to get the contract for the World Trade Center. What's key to understand here is that this name, Shaul Eisenberg, he's the millionaire, billionaire guy, the big Mossad agent out in Asia. And he spends most of his time in Japan and China and whatnot. And he created this company for the sole purpose of getting the security contract for the World Trade Center. So these are the two characters who were involved in negotiations. Shalom Ben-Dor is on the bottom. But when the Port Authority discovered that Avraham Shalom was using a fake name and that he had this background as a murderer in Israel, I mean convicted of murder, they tore up the security contract. They reneged on it. And that ended the contract. But had the contract gone through, 9/11 probably would have happened in the late 80s or maybe early 90s. And we would have been at a great disadvantage because we didn't have the internet. We had no way of really sharing information. But they were thwarted. They were thwarted. These guys were Zvi Malkin on the top. And these are big agents of Yisr Harel. They were involved, for example, in operations like when they went to Argentina and kidnapped Eichmann. These guys were involved in that. These guys were involved in smuggling plutonium from Pennsylvania to Israel for the nuclear weapons programs. So these are senior agents. And they came to New York with the sole purpose of getting the security contract for the World Trade Center. So the plan was moving forward. This is 1980s. When they were thwarted, when they were blocked by that tearing up of the contract, that didn't stop them. They went to work for these men. They went to work for Jules Krull and Maurice Greenberg. You might remember Maurice Greenberg down here in the bottom picture. He's the man whose company, AIG, received a $180 billion bailout between the Bush and Obama administrations, right there on the threshold. Half went from Bush, half went from Obama. And he ran a criminal enterprise. His AIG insurance company was a criminal enterprise. He admitted it himself. He said, if we were legal, we wouldn't be in business. But, you know, never mind. They also got control. They had a little company, Krull Associates, the man Jules Krull at the top. They had a company called Krull Associates, which is like one of these security companies. And they got Krull Associates got the security contract for the World Trade Center after the first bombing in 1993. You remember there was a bomb in the basement. Six people were killed. Then they said, we need new security programs. So they went to Krull Associates. And Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor was now working for Krull. So, like in a Trojan horse method, he got in that way. Now, The fourth point is that Israel created the Islamic foe. They created the bad guy, the boogeyman, the other out there that we had to fear. And they did it during the early 80s when the Soviet Union Red Army had invaded Afghanistan. And then, of course, there were these Afghans who fled to Pakistan who needed arms. And the United States began arming these Pakistanis, or the Afghans in Pakistan, to go back and fight. But the only gang that got the lion's share of the money was an anti-Western force called Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Why? Here are these people in Afghanistan, they're protesting about this Gulbuddin, that's what he looks like, and they say imposing the vicious gang of Gulbuddin on our people is another crime of the U.S. government. It's true. It goes back to the 80s. But it wasn't just the Americans. Thousands of Arabs joined this group called Hezb Islami. This was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group. They were extremely anti-Western. And at the time when they began funding this operation to arm these people, the money came from CIA and came from Saudi Arabia. These two hands were giving the money. But they were giving it to Israeli military intelligence, who was doing the arming and the training of this group. They were teaching them terrorism. They were teaching them how to make bombs and bicycles explode and urban terrorism. And what happened is that these Arabs came to join with the Afghans fighting the Red Army in what's called a jihad. And in this Arab-Afghan-Arab group, the most well-known one is Osama bin Laden. And in 1984, at exactly the time that Israeli military intelligence was training and arming these guys, here comes Osama bin Laden. So it was done in 1983, 84, and 85. That's when they began. And it was at the time that Israeli military intelligence was training these people, it was headed by none other than Ehud Barak. That's very important to understand. And it was done by, the program in America is understood through a movie called Charlie Wilson's War, or a book called Charlie Wilson's War. The movie's okay, but I really recommend reading the book. Because the movie doesn't explain the Israeli connection. You don't understand anything about the Israeli connection. If you read the book, you will see that this entire thing was actually being run by the Mossad. And Charlie Wilson was just like their puppet. He was like doing what they were telling him to do. And he was going to be famous. So Charlie Wilson was the congressman who arranged for the CIA to give the money for the Israeli weapons. And so this is Gulbuddin Hekmatyar down below and Charlie Wilson shaking hands. But the question is, why would the CIA and Israeli military intelligence arm and train the most virulently anti-Western mujahideen? It makes no sense. It's like, why would you do that? Well, because they were creating for the enemy for the next war. They were creating the boogeyman for the war on terror. Here's the connection, very simple. Zvi Rafia, the man down below, was Mossad station chief in Washington. When Charlie Wilson was elected down in Texas in 1973, he fell under this man's into his domain, and they became very good friends. And whenever Charlie Wilson went to Israel, Zvi Rafia took care of all of his meetings, who he would see, what he would talk to. He was being taken around. And in the book, it says that Zvi Rafia, Mossad station chief, used Charlie Wilson's congressional office as if it were his own. Now, if you've ever been to a congressional office, you know it's big. A congressional office takes about the size of half this library because they have lots and lots of rooms. And they have lots and lots of stuff, people working there, communications, etc. In the book, it says this. Rafia always acted as if he owned Wilson's office. One of the staffers kept a list of people he needed to lobby. He would use the phones, give projects to the staff, and call on Charlie to intervene whenever he needed him. So he was using American workers, you know, interns and whatnot, in the congressman's office to work for Israeli intelligence. Aren't they clever? And here's Osama bin Laden's first trainer. This is a very interesting story. I can't go into great detail. The man's name is Ali Muhammad, 1M. It's not misspelled. That's Ali Muhammad. And you'll read about this guy. There's a lot written about him. He's a Hebrew-speaking Egyptian. Now, I can tell you, I've lived in Egypt and I lived in Israel. You don't learn Hebrew in Egypt. So he learned Hebrew on the job, and he's probably a triple agent. He was the first trainer for Osama bin Laden. He also set up the cell in Nairobi that bombed the U.S. embassies in Africa. He also trained the men who bombed the World Trade Center. He also trained the men who shot Rabbi Kahana. He was involved in everything. And this man was finally put in prison in a federal penitentiary in this country for his involvement in bombing the African embassies, the embassies in Africa. And from the federal penitentiary, he simply vanished without a trace. And here, Gulbuddin becomes al-Qaeda. In 1994, after losing Saudi and Pakistani support, the remainder of Hezb Islami merged into al-Qaeda and Taliban. Taliban is basically the Afghans, the Pashtuns, and al-Qaeda is the Arab-speaking. So it's these are the people who were trained by Israeli military intelligence. They became al-Qaeda. So then the next point is that, you know, after that bombing in the World Trade Center in 1993 in February, the case became a Zionist case again. The prosecutor was Michael Chertoff and other Zionists. Michael Chertoff was the chief guy in New Jersey because the conspiracy happened in New Jersey. And it fell into the court of his fellow Zionist judge, Michael Mukasey. And what they did is this was a very odd case, but what they were doing is they were framing our mind that we would understand that Arabs were trying to bring down the World Trade Center, that this was an Arab plot, when in fact it wasn't an Arab plot at all. Even if you read the New York Times, you'll see that it was a complete setup. It went like this. February 1993, the first false bombing hit the World Trade Center in the basement. It caused a lot of damage, but it didn't go anywhere near bringing the buildings down. Six people were killed, and as I said, Chertoff and Mukasey framed the case against the blind sheikh. Now, here's the blind sheikh smiling back there with sunglasses on, and he's being led out of the room by a man named Emad Salem. Emad Salem was an Egyptian colonel who came to this country and was involved working with the FBI as the informant. He was the FBI's informant. So he was getting into his circle men who could be held responsible for the crime that was going to happen. And that's what he did. He was paid Emad Salem was paid $1 million for his testimony. Michael Chertoff played a key role in the prosecution. So what happened is that these innocent Muslims, like the blind sheikh, were sent away to jail for like 5,000 years. This guy took his $1 million and went into the witness protection program and lives happily ever after. But there are tapes of him talking to the FBI about making the bomb and who made the bomb, who's going to blow up the bomb. And you can tell from his voice that he's very he feels very dismayed at the way the whole thing turned out in the end. Of course he did. Then the Zionist plans for revamping the American military required something called the New Pearl Harbor. This is before 9/11 still. There was a series of articles and ideas, think tanks, that called for a new Pearl Harbor. One of the most important ones is this one. This was in the Foreign Affairs magazine, which is a CFR publication. It was written, it's the report of what's called a study group. Philip Zelikow had a catastrophic terrorism study group. And in his study group was Ashton Carter. That name might be familiar. Minister of Secretary of Defense under Obama. And John Deutsch, former head of the CIA. And they had this catastrophic terrorism study group for a year or so. And then they produced this report. And as you can see from the beginning of the article, they were imagining the transforming event. They were imagining that event that would change this country. That act of catastrophic terrorism. This is 1998, December. They were imagining this tremendous catastrophe that would change America forever. And this paper was basically laying out when that happens, what we would have to do. This is like think tank material. Here are the two of the men that wrote it, along with Philip Zelikow. They are at the top left, Ashton Carter, and the man with the blue sweater in the middle, that's John Deutsch. They worked for a company at the time called Global Technology Partners, which is an exclusive affiliate of Rothschild North America. Now, you'll hear throughout this presentation many times Rothschild, because what you find is that in almost every case, the entity that's doing the dirty work is owned by the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds are two or three steps back, but they're always part of the picture, but they're like behind the scenes. And of course, the Rothschild North America owns this company because they make acquisitions and investments in technology, defense, and aerospace related companies. Because that $2.5 trillion has to be spent somewhere. Somebody has to take it home at the end of the day. And they want to be the one to take it home. So again, this is another group called the Project for a New American Century. And 1 year before 9/11, they came out with a paper called Rebuilding America's Defenses. Again, it's a policy paper, how America should be on the... In the paper, it said that the United States should invade Iraq and build permanent bases in Iraq, whether Saddam Hussein is there or not. And then they call this transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, you know, America being the police of the whole world, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. 1 year before. If you recall the debates in the year 2000, in the presidential election of 2000, George Bush was asked several times what was his opinion on regime change. Because the people who knew, the politicians, the journalists knew that this was in the cards, and they wanted to see what he would say about it. Now, the next point is that Israeli Mossad controlled security at U.S. airports on 9/11. So that's a foreign country's intelligence controlled passenger screening and security operations at Boston's Logan, at Newark Airport, at Dulles on 9/11. The company is called ICTS, and these are the three principal executives, Ed Sukerman, Yair Shamir, and Boaz Harel, Israelis. Mossad and Kukerman is the Rothschild guy. Next point is Israelis create false histories for alleged hijackers. So 15 of the 19 hijackers, alleged hijackers, lived in Florida, in down south in Hollywood and Del Rey. Duplicate licenses had been issued for at least six of them. The strange thing was, is one guy would go get his license on a Wednesday. The next day, on Thursday, somebody using his name would call up to DMV or whatever you call it here, motor vehicles, and say, yeah, I moved to a new apartment last night and I need a new license with my new address. Can you send one to me? And they did. And they did like half a dozen like that. And it happened the very next day. This was reported in the Florida press. It was very interesting. So somebody was creating false documents or duplicate documents for these fellas in order to create false histories. Now that's a little bit complicated, but it's very well explained in this book, which was written by John Le Carré. Again, it's a film and a book, but I recommend the book first because the movie's a little complicated, because this stuff is a little complicated, to be quite honest. But in this book, The Little Drummer Girl, it's written with the help of Israeli intelligence agents from the head of the Shin Bet military intelligence. They helped John Le Carré write the book in 1982. And what they do is they lay a false trail for a Palestinian guy from Turkey all the way to Germany. Then they blow up a synagogue, but they don't really blow it up. They put charges in the windows and things like that. They make it look like a bomb. And then they blow up the car with the Palestinian guy in it. He's dead already. So the takeaway is that Palestinian terrorists are blowing up synagogues in Germany. But none of it happened. It's all fake. It's Israeli control. So the book is very interesting. And in the book, the Mossad guy says to the actress Diane Keaton, who is the actress, she's working with the Mossad in this operation. And he says, terror is theater. Theater is a con trick. Do you know what that means? Con trick? You've been deceived. It's all the name of the game, deception. Terrorism is all about deception. So in July 2001, the Zionists got the control of the World Trade Center. Basically, 5 weeks before 9/11 happened, they got control. How it happened like this, it's very interesting. Ronald Lauder, the son of Estee Lauder, the cosmetic magnate, he was made the director of Governor Pataki's privatization scheme. And this is for the state of New York. And he decided what properties would be privatized. And he decided, we'll privatize the World Trade Center. You have to understand, the World Trade Center was basically public property. It belonged to the states of New York and New Jersey, the Port Authority. And so they shifted these two monstrous buildings, these two huge buildings, to private ownership for a penny, for really a penny. And they went to this Larry Silverstein. This is how it happened. Ronald Lauder ran the scheme, and Lauder is very closely connected to the Mossad. He actually has a school called the Lauder School of Government, Diplomacy and Strategy at Mossad University in Herzliya, IDC, Interdisciplinary Center. And at his school, the Lauder School, the head of the Institute for Policy and Strategy is none other than Danny Rothschild, this Israeli high general, aloof Major General Danny Rothschild. He's also from Rishon LeZion. So I guess those Rothschilds, when they made their settlement down there, their first settlement, they left some children behind. And so that's the connection there. Now, this man then turned over the negotiations to this man here at the top, Lou Eisenberg. Lou Eisenberg was the director general, executive of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, the owners of the building. And then there were some convoluted negotiations going on with a company called Vornado Realty and Larry Silverstein. They made the negotiations very tough for Vornado, so Vornado got up and walked out. And then they went to Larry Silverstein. Now, there's a connection here as well. Larry Silverstein and Lou Eisenberg are both board members of something called the UJA, United Jewish Appeal of New York, the Federation. This is the funding organization to raise funds for the State of Israel in New York and the nation. It's the largest funding organization. Larry Silverstein was the national chairman, and Mr. Eisenberg was on the planning board. So there again, you see, there's this connection. There's this back room connection that you don't know about, or some people might say it's not polite to talk about it, but it's there, it's real. Now, here's another backroom connection. Bibi Netanyahu and Larry Silverstein are very good friends. Every Sunday afternoon, they had a conversation on the telephone for years. This is from a Haaretz newspaper, and the quote is, "For years, Netanyahu and Silverstein have kept in close touch. Every Sunday afternoon, New York time, Netanyahu would call Silverstein. It made no difference where Netanyahu was. He would always call. Their ties continued after Netanyahu became prime minister in 1996. And here we have Larry Silverstein on the day that he got the keys to the World Trade Center with his lawyer and his wife and his daughter. And he said, "I am proud to assume the stewardship of the World Trade Center, one of New York's greatest jewels, July 24th, 2001. Basically 5-6 weeks before the atrocity. And this is what was left on 9/11. Nothing but dust and ash. Biblical devastation on a biblical scale. The head of Israeli military came on the TV in London on 9/11 giving his interpretation of what we had experienced. Before the towers had even fallen, before the dust had settled, this man was on TV in London on the biggest English network in the world, BBC World, seen around the world. And he said this. He said, "The world will never be the same from today on." He said, "We know it's an Osama bin Laden operation." He said, "Now it's time to launch an operational concrete war against terror." So these Israelis were telling us from the very first minute, "Now it's time. Let's go. War on terror. Here we come." What's the connection between Netanyahu and Ehud Barak? Again, very small world. Ehud Barak, with the sunglasses, was the commander of the Sayeret Matkal organization and group that Bibi Netanyahu was in. And this is a covert commando force that serves directly under Israeli military intelligence. Bibi Netanyahu's brother, Yonatan, died in an operation where the Sayeret Matkal went down to Africa, to Uganda, I think it was. There had been a hijacking in Teba. And in that operation, his brother was killed. And that's why they call their institute Yonatan Institute. But these two men have this long military history together. Bibi was his soldier. Bibi was his man, his soldier. And other members of the Sayeret Matkal were involved in 9/11. For example, on Flight 11, Daniel Levin of Akimai, he was also a former Sayeret Matkal. Now, another strange thing is on the day of 9/11, Ehud Olmert, the Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, this man here looking at the camera, was in New York City. He had been in New York City. He had been in Canada on the 9th or the 10th in Ottawa at a fundraiser. He came to New York City, and on the 10th of September in New York City, he made a transaction in which he sold the Likud football team. But the strange thing is that he's the mayor of the sister city of New York. Jerusalem and New York City are sister cities. And yet his visit was kept secret. Why? Why was it kept secret? And then, of course, on 9/11 in the afternoon, he apparently left on that Boeing Israeli LL-747 that left. One plane was allowed to leave on the afternoon from New York City. It was an LL-747. Went back to Israel. Here he is. I would point out also that he's in the background. He's currently in jail in Israel. He's been in jail for about a year now on, I think it's bribery. And Bibi Netanyahu is not far from jail as well. There's several cases pending against him, very serious cases in Israel. involving Arnon Milchan, too, by the way. But so Ehud Olmert was in New York City on 9/11, but why was his visit kept secret? Now, the five dancing Israelis. These are also a very interesting thing. On 9/11, I was driving through Pennsylvania. We had been in New York City that morning, and we were coming back to Chicago. We couldn't go to Washington. And Ted Koppel came on the news about noon and said that the FBI was looking for five Middle Eastern men who were seen videotaping and celebrating the attack on the World Trade Center. I thought, that's interesting. That was the first time Middle Eastern had been mentioned. I told my wife, they could be Israelis, because Israelis are Middle Eastern. And lo and behold, that's what happened. The next day, it turned out these men were arrested in New Jersey. They were arrested on 9/11. And two of them, the two on the far right, are actually Mossad agents. And they're known to U.S. law enforcement as being agents of Mossad. The other three here are basically sub-agents, operatives, working with. And they were arrested in New Jersey, and they were pulled over. They had been videotaping and filming the World Trade Center burning, and as they did so, they were clicking their lighters and giving high fives and things like that. And they were observed by a lady in New Jersey who called the FBI, called the police, and then the New Jersey police caught them. And they had like multiple passports stuck in their socks, and they had thousands of dollars stuck in their socks, and their van tested positive for explosives, and they had box cutters. They told the police that, yeah, we were by the World Trade Center this morning, we were there. And what happened is then they went back to Israel, and after being held for about 2 months in Brooklyn in the lockup, and they went on TV. And the three who were not Mossad agents, the three younger guys, admitted. They said in Hebrew, our purpose was to document the event. Now, the interviewer might have asked, well, who sent you there to do that? But he didn't ask the question. The man that ran the show is Yair Lapid. He became the finance minister shortly after that. But this is the Israeli audience watched this whole show. Israelis all across the country heard this in pure Hebrew and understood. Well, these guys were there, they knew, you know, they were doing their job. Now, another point is that thousands of Israelis were reported to have been at the World Trade Center that day. This is a Jerusalem Post article, and it says that the foreign ministry in Jerusalem has so far received the names of 4,000 Israelis believed to have been in the area of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon at the time of the attack. Now, that's how many people called in, how many families called in and said, I'm worried about Shlomo, I'm worried about this guy, I'm worried about that guy, my son is there, my husband is there. Well, what happened, of those 4,000 people who were supposedly there, only three or four died. Three or four Israelis died in the whole operation. Well, how did they avoid harm? Well, what clearly happened also is that there was an instant messaging service called Odigo, an Israeli instant messaging service, that sent out a warning 2 hours before 9/11 happened, warning people not to go to the World Trade Center that day because there would be a catastrophe there. And the vice president of the company said that the prediction, the time, was exact to the minute, so 8:45. And the message was sent out on a platform that you could receive through your BlackBerry or your BlueBerry or your cell phone or your internet, whatever. And so all platforms. But it was sent out in Hebrew, and it was sent out using a buddy system where you could say, I'm going to send this message to all Israelis on the system who obviously speak Hebrew, boom, boom, boom. And by choosing those parameters, everybody on that whole network who shared Odigo got the message. And they didn't go to work. They didn't go to the World Trade Center that day. They did something else. Like Larry Silverstein, they went to the doctor. Like Al Franken, they stayed and visited their mom. Some other guy, they went water skiing. Did anything else, but didn't go to work that day. Now, another interesting thing is this put options. There were a lot of put options. These are short options. This is a financial trade where you expect a stock to go down. You're betting that a stock's going to go down. So there were an extraordinary amount of people who bet that United Airlines and American Airlines stock would go down, along with other insurance companies and things like that, would go down on 9/11. And they did go down. So those people won money on that bet. It's like gambling. It's called a put option. And in the investigation was done by, of course, this SEC or Securities and Exchange Commission, and it's done in Chicago. This options trading is centered in Chicago, Chicago Board of Options Exchange. And what we found out from this is that a single U.S.-based institutional investor with no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda purchased 95% of the United Airlines puts on September 6th as part of a strategy that also included buying 115,000 shares of American on September 10th. This is from the 9/11 Commission report, a footnote. Well, it turned out that that little company belonged to this man who was the executive director of the CIA at the time. His name is Buzzy Krongard. Krongard is a fake name. It's actually a Polish-Jewish name. But he said it was written in the Independent magazine newspaper, to the embarrassment of investigators, it has also emerged that the firm used to buy many of the put options was headed until 1998 by Buzzy Krongard, now executive director of the CIA. Until 1997, Mr. Krongard was chairman of Alex. Brown Incorporated, America's oldest investment banking firm. And this is based in Baltimore, and it's connected also to Deutsche Bank and things. But Buzzy Krongard, there with his wife and his friend, lives on this huge estate. This is the view from Google. This is his estate in Maryland. And I called him up. I did call him up, and I sent him my books for free. I should have charged him, but I sent him the books because, you know, you can actually get through to some of these people, and you can embarrass them a little bit. You can let them know that, you know, we know something about you. Now, here's Alvin Krongard. That's Buzzy Krongard. He was executive director of the CIA. That position no longer exists. But what the executive director did, he's the guy that ran the operation day in and day out. Operations were run. Daily operations were run by Buzzy Krongard. The other guys like Tenet, they're just window dressing. They're just like, they're there for image. I'm the director of the CIA. But he doesn't do anything. It's the operational guy that does it. When you look at organizations like that, you got to look at who's number two and number three. Those are the guys who get the job done. But if you look here with Buzzy Krongard, here's Buzzy Alvin. Buzzy Krongard is here. His wife is here. You see the direct line from his wife to Rothschild Asset Management. Again, you see, you have to see who these people are connected to. And Central Intelligence, of course, and Alex Brown, directly to Alvin. The Rothschilds are not mentioned in the news, but they're right there. Now, the next point is that the investigation of 9/11. 9/11 was a terrible crime of mass murder, but it was not investigated as such. Rather, it became a non-investigation headed by this man. And he's an Israeli national. His name is Michael Sheratov. His mother was a Mossad agent. He was raised in Israel. He grew up a lot of his childhood in Israel. And he was the assistant attorney general in charge of the criminal division of the Department of Justice on 9/11. So it fell into his lap. He was the person in charge of prosecuting the crime, if there were to be any prosecution, but there was no prosecution. Rather, John Ashcroft put Sheratov in charge of the 9/11 Commission, and for day-to-day decisions, Sheratov has the last word. Now, if you remember anything about John Ashcroft, he's gone deep into hiding now. Ashcroft is a Christian Zionist from Missouri who actually lost an election to a dead man. And now he has a company called Ashcroft Consulting, and his number one client, Israel Aircraft Industries. So they keep him on the gravy train to keep him silent so he doesn't cause any problem. And then Michael Sheratov became the second head of Homeland Security. I point this out because this is very important, because in this position he was able to maintain his control of the evidence. You have to understand, the evidence of 9/11 was destroyed, and access to and discussion of the evidence was verboten because Sheratov was in charge of it. So all the crucial evidence was destroyed. But due to something called SSI, Sensitive Security Intelligence, I think it's called, Michael Sheratov remained in the position of overseeing. He was the spider. He remained the spider in charge of access to the evidence until he finished his term here. So like for the better part of the first decade, Michael Sheratov controlled all access to 9/11 evidence. And what they did is they destroyed it. And again, I sound like a broken record. The destruction of the evidence from the World Trade Center was done by two Zionist junkyards in New Jersey. And I finished my book about that. It's the final chapter is the destruction of the evidence, because it's very important to understand that the two junkyards that handled this evidence were themselves Israeli-run operations. So that no American got close to it. One of the junkyards was the Napurano junkyard. Napurano, he's an Italian guy, right? He had his family-run junkyard for generations. But just like a year before, 6 months before, some gangster, Israeli gangster from Canada, CIBC, came down and bought out his junkyard, and then they hired him as consultant for them. So he would then only act as consultant. His junkyard, not Burano, but what happened here is that the junk was taken, this stuff was taken across the river to New Jersey. It was being cut up 24 hours a day, 24/7, it was being cut up into pieces 5 feet and shorter, mixed with other scrap, and put into ships going to Asia. And just they had just dredged the Clermont Channel to facilitate that these larger ships would be able to take this stuff to Asia. They could go right up to the junkyard, and they dredged the channel. The junkyard had paid $25 million to have that channel dredged. This was all set up before. And the guys that oversaw the whole network of trading the steel to China, they came to the United States from Mark Rich. They were Mark Rich's team. Two Belgian Jews came over, and they set up the organization to get the steel to China. And the steel was being sent to China at a time when scrap steel was at the lowest value point in 50 years. And you're spending $25 a ton to ship it to Asia? It makes no sense, unless the only reason you're doing it is to destroy the evidence. It makes no business sense. So they had tons and tons of the steel that had to be destroyed, because the steel, you see, would show what destroyed it. No steel frame building has ever fallen due to fire. So this other agents were used, you know, thermite, super thermite, and other things. And the steel has a memory of that. You can look at the steel, and you can see what vaporized here, it melted there. You know, you can see explosions leave indelible traces on steel. You had to destroy it. That's what they were doing. And then Zionists presided over the 9/11 lawsuits. There was a lawsuit, tort litigation, with 96 families who refused to take the money. They didn't take the compensation money. They held out for a trial, 96 families, and one by one by one, they were settled out of court. And this is the judge who said, you know, money's a great lubricant. You should take the money and go. And here's the judge. Alvin Hellerstein was the federal judge who handled the 9/11 tort litigation. His son Joseph had a conflict of interest that his son was the lawyer in Israel that represented the key defendant, ICTS, that company I showed you before. The Kugerman Rothschild company that ran security operations at the airports that day. That was the key defendant. The families wanted to know who's responsible for the loss of their loved one. And that airline security company, the passenger security company that let those guys on the plane, if they were even on the plane, was obviously the key defendant. But the judge, he said at the end of the trial, "You're just a parent company. I don't see why you're here. You can go home." So he excused that company, the Israeli company, flat out. The Mossad company got excused by the Zionist judge. Here's the connection, basically, is that you saw the ICTS company was headed by a guy named Kukerman. His son, Joseph Hellerstein, was an Israeli lawyer with the firm that represents Kukerman, which is the parent company of ICTS. And again, Kukerman was also the CEO of the Rothschild Group in Israel and chairman of the Israel General Bank. So that's the situation, but I couldn't get the New York media to report this. I presented this in several articles. I talked about it a great deal when I discovered it. Finally, one of the lawyers took it to the U.S. Supreme Court and asked that it be entered into the document as a record. But he was scolded by the court and sanctioned for anti-Semitism. And here are the people that dealt with settling the cases. As I said, there were 3,000 wrongful death cases, basically. The top man is Kenneth Feinberg. He's always special master. He was special master in this case of the 9/11 Compensation Fund. And he dealt with every family and gave them, with his wife, some money. Whether $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, it was up to him. And he and his wife did this together. And his wife is executive of the United Israel Appeal and the Jewish Federation of Washington. And she sits on the board of governors of the Jewish Agency. So you can see, these are, again, highest level Zionist players dishing out the U.S. compensation to these poor people. And Sheila Birnbaum, the lady down here, is then the lady who dealt with the remaining 96 families, those people who held out for a trial. Because once you take the money, you're out of the litigation. The 96 families wanted to stay with it and find out who did it. And one by one, she waged what I call a judicial war of attrition. One settling family after family after family. 96 families, it would fill this room up. And one by one, they were settled. So that here we are, 15 years later, there has never been a trial for 9/11. There never will be a trial for 9/11. There's been no legal discovery in the court. That's what they wanted. Because when you carry out a false flag terror operation like this, there are three things you have to control. You have to control the investigation and access to the evidence. That was Michael Sheratoff. You have to control the interpretation, how the event is explained to the people. And thirdly, you have to control the litigation so that no legal discovery comes out that will contradict the official story. And this Michael Mukasey, he was part of that. He was the judge who oversaw the 1993 bombing case, which was basically, as I said, meant to impress upon the American people that Arabs and Muslims are trying to break down the World Trade Center. That was the takeaway. They even made movies about it. So that at the end of the movie, you know, one of the bad Arabs is in the back of the vehicle, handcuffed and everything, and he says, they drive past the World Trade Center, and he says, next time we'll bring them both down. So that people watch and say, ooh, the nasty Arabs could bring down the World Trade Center. So then when it does actually happen in reality, you say, oh, yeah, sure, dude, yeah, did you see the movie? Yes, Arabs did it, sure, who else? Oh, this judge also oversaw the Larry Silverstein's battle with the insurance companies, in which Larry Silverstein got double indemnity, got paid twice, because he had very cleverly written the insurance contract with the insurance company against acts of terrorism. And so he received double payment, two separate acts of terrorism. So from $100 million that Larry Silverstein put down of borrowed money from GMAC, which went bankrupt, of course, in 2008, he got $5.2 billion from borrowed money. So he put down a tuppence. He put down just a couple cents and received all this money. So now he's built this monstrosity in the middle of Manhattan, you know, this huge World Trade Center Tower 1. Now, one of the last points is that Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has admitted on several occasions that 9/11 is good for Israel, that the attacks of 9/11 were good for Israel. On 9/11 itself, on the very day of the attack, the New York Times asked him, how will this affect Israeli-American relations? And he said, it's very good. He said, well, it's not very good, but it'll generate immediate sympathy. But at the time of 9/11, it was thought that 30,000 people were dead in the rubble. 30,000. Who would say it's good? Who would use the word good to describe that, except somebody who saw some ulterior motive, some benefit? Well, he saw a benefit, all right. A couple years later, he said exactly that. He's speaking in Hebrew here at Bar-Ilan University, speaking to an Israeli audience, and he said, we Israelis are benefiting from one thing, and that is the attack on the Twin Towers and Pentagon and the American struggle in Iraq. I want to point out again that he's been the chairman of the Likud since 1993. So what benefit did Israel get from this? What benefit did Israel get? Well, they got America waging war across the Middle East, taking out their enemies one by one. That's what they got. And then now the next point is that the Zionists control the 9/11 myth. We've been given a myth as Americans. We've been given this thick book, 9/11 Commission. We've been sold a myth, a pack of lies. This is the 9/11 Commission report. It was written by Philip Zelikow, the same guy who did that catastrophic study, terrorism study, with Ashton Carter and John Deutsch. In March of 2003, myth specialist Philip Zelikow completed the outline of the 9/11 Commission report before the staff even began working. He had it all lined out, outlined, bullet points, subtitles, and he was executive director of the commission. And, you know, he was chosen after Henry Kissinger was turned down. Henry Kissinger was going to be the guy, but then when Henry Kissinger didn't want to, release his list of clients, they gave it to this guy. So this is a very important position because as executive director, he framed the agenda, led the research staff, and decided what evidence the commission would see. That's very important. It's like how it works in a courtroom, right? What evidence they allow you to see. Well, here, this is the senior counsel for the 9/11 Commission. His name is John Farmer. And he said, what government and military officials told Congress, the commission, the media, and the public about who knew what when was almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. And the commissioners themselves said, to this day, we don't know why NORAD told us what they told us. It was just so far from the truth. So the 9/11 Commission report is, you know, from its own writers. You see, 6 out of the 10 9/11 Commission members have gone on record since to admit that there was a U.S. government cover-up. But it wasn't the U.S. government that was doing the covering up. It was Philip Zelikow. Now, the last point is that Israelis then built the memorial, the 9/11 memorial at Ground Zero. They call it Ground Zero. This is where the footprint of the towers are. They built these pools of flowing water into the pools, and memorial, you know, names carved into the granite around the building. This was designed by an Israeli who's a friend of the Netanyahu family. This man here, the young man here. The World Trade Center Memorial was designed by an Israeli, Michael Arad, son of Moshe Arad, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. So, I mean, of course, this selection process was probably through the mayor of New York and a board, but they chose this Israeli guy to build the memorial. So that's very important. So even the legacy, of 9/11 is designed by the people who are involved in the perpetration of the crime. So when young American kids go, you know, school buses go to this place every day, and they go and they walk through the memorial, they get fed the official story, official myth, exactly as it's meant to be fed to them. One point is that the Jewish woman who runs the memorial in New York was previously the head of the Holocaust Museum. So they're very good at presenting a gut-wrenching, compelling story to young people to get them emotionally attached to this narrative. Mayor Bloomberg and Israeli leader Netanyahu discussed the Israeli names at the 9/11 memorial, all four of them, on September 22, 2011. And the New York Times, however, has completely avoided any discussion of the evidence that disproves the official myth. And there's a lot of it. I can't get into it in this short presentation, but like the molten metal that fell from the buildings, the drops of molten iron that are found in the dust, the incredible hot spots that raged below the rubble for 3 months. None of that was discussed by the New York Times, because the New York Times took this position. This is an editorial, lead editorial from 3 years after 9/11. And they wrote, "In the 3 years since 9/11, we've begun to understand that it's possible to know what happened without knowing what happened." And they leave it at that. You don't need to know what happened. And they say that some of what we need to know publicly has been provided by the report of the 9/11 Commission. Other answers are lacking, like what happened to Building 7. Why did that building fall down at 5:20 in the afternoon? None of this is discussed in the media, because the media, you see, is the one that interprets our politics for us. And now you see the media is all gung-ho about attacking the new president. At that time, they were just gung-ho about telling us that Islamic terrorists are a threat to our nation. They destroy the World Trade Center, and we have to go to war against... You know, when George Bush and Dick Cheney were asked about establishing a blue ribbon investigation, they told the congressman from South Dakota, "No, we can't have an investigation. That would take away from our war effort in Afghanistan." What, a big country like this can't investigate the crime and wage a war in a small country in Asia at the same time? So for 15 years, the controlled media has pushed a false narrative. That's a story. That's a fairy tale, a myth about 9/11 and the war on terror, all the while suppressing the evidence that disproves the official myth. So the American people are like in those kids in Socrates' cave. You're only seeing a shadow play on the wall. You're not getting the truth. You're not getting any of the truth about 9/11. It takes a lot of research and time and effort to... But the information is there. The actual evidence of the lies, proving the lies, is all there in the government documents. But the media doesn't tell you about it. That's the catch. And how does that work? Again, the Rothschilds. Rupert Murdoch here, he's the owner of like 160 newspapers in this country. He owns the Wall Street Journal. He owns Paramount. He owns all kinds of Chicago Sun-Times. He came to this country from Australia in the 1980s and started buying up media properties across the country. Now, nobody said, like, where's the money come from? How does this little guy from Australia come over here and start buying up newspapers like Chicago Sun-Times? What, these guys in America don't know how to run a newspaper? Well, he was backed by a guy with very deep pockets, Jacob Rothschild here. And why do they do this? Well, first of all, media moguls like Rupert Murdoch, who have promoted the lies about 9/11, he owns Fox News, by the way, and War on Terror, are complicit with the terrorists who bombed the Twin Towers. And the Rothschild banksters create media moguls like him in order to control public opinion. Now, here's another point, you know, minor point perhaps, but these two men own the oil on the Golan Heights in Syria. Golan Heights is occupied territory, of course. It's Syria. Israel's occupied it since the Six-Day War. There's an oil company up there working to extract the oil from the Golan Heights. It's illegal, of course. It's owned by these two men. And furthermore, Mr. Rothschild owns the oil in northern Iraq, the largest oil company in Kurdistan, where 10,000 U.S. troops are currently fighting. He owns the oil company since 2002. So you see, there's always a little catch in there. There's always some little nugget, some strategic asset, some mineral that they want out of it, and they always extract it. In Yugoslavia, his son, Nathan Rothschild, took over Montenegro, basically the whole Montenegro, the one of the small, very beautiful parts of Europe. And they have a nice Bay of Kotor there. And the Bay of Kotor, Nathan Rothschild and his friend Oleg Deripaska, they built a large marina, casino, all that kind of stuff for yachts. And they had a business partner. Business partner was Saif al-Islam, Gaddafi. Interesting. I wrote about this. Gaddafi is working with Nathan Rothschild in Montenegro with Oleg Deripaska. These guys are gangsters. Why is... And then you know what happened to Saif al-Islam. He's living... He's wanted man now. His family... All of the gold of Gaddafi's gone, disappeared. The $285 billion in their Swiss deposits have disappeared. Where did it all go? Libya was plundered. And I think that when they got buddy-buddy with Saif al-Islam, they found out where the gold was. And they found out where the accounts were. Then they said, now we go to action. And by the way, the Rothschilds also own, in Mali, in West Africa, they own the three oil companies. They have a 10-year plan to extract all the gold from Mali. Now, Mali has historically been a gold-rich country in Africa. And you remember when the French went down there and they started fighting with these northerners and southerners in Mali? It made it sound like this was an al-Qaeda operation. No, they were protecting the gold fields. So the final slide is this one. We've lost a couple people from our audience, I'm sorry to say. But this is Dr. Alan Sabrowski, who wrote this piece called Treason, Betrayal, and Deceit, 9/11 Beyond, in 2009. And this sums up what I've tried to present here, is that the evidential trail, the trail of evidence for 9/11 and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq runs from PNAC, Project for a New American Century, AIPAC, American-Israeli Lobby, and their cohorts, through the mostly Jewish neocons in the Bush administration, and back to the Israeli government. None of the denials and political machinations can alter that essential reality. And that's where I end. You can see that the evidence indicates that both 9/11 and the war on terror come from the same place and it's part of an agenda. And we have been deceived. It's not an American agenda. We are being bled dry. We've been snookered into this. We've been deceived. And a nation that is so deceived cannot survive. If we don't awaken from this deception, and if we don't put an end to this horrendous crime and expose who really did 9/11, it'll be bad for all of us. So thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.